all of that then, if I may, at the same time, and then you won't have to hear from me again. I want to say about Professor Todd Bridge that the field he's going to talk about, that is futurism, is something that I didn't even know existed. I never thought that the future existed until one day in the locker room at BYU several years ago, I began to hear Todd Bridge talking about Alvin Toffler's future shock, and began to realize that the study of the future was a whole area that I, as a historian, had completely ignored. And I was and I was delighted to understand that there really is something sensible that can be said about it. Although, as I understand it, Professor Bridge is probably a conservative among futurists, and the very title of his talk, Back from the Future, probably suggests that he has some of his own questions about it. But we are delighted, or at least I'm personally delighted, to introduce a man whom I believe is one of the most universally respected teachers on the campus of Brigham Young University, recognized by both students and colleagues as someone who is both a fine scholar and a caring, sensitive teacher. I won't give you all of his credentials, except to say that he did receive the Carl G. Major Distinguished Teaching Award, and this year he has received a grant from the David M. Kennedy Center for International Area Studies to do research on Marx and aesthetics, so he's very diversified in his interests. He also serves as a member of the Executive Committee of the Utah Endowment for the Humanities. Professor Ritchie, who will comment immediately after Professor Bridge has finished his talk, is a professor of organizational behavior at Brigham Young University. I also got acquainted with him at the locker room at BYU, so we all play a lot of racquetball. He received his graduate PhD degree from the University of California at Berkeley. He's taught at the University of Michigan, and he's been at BYU since 1973. His research and his publication, some of which you've seen in Sunstone magazine, is directly connected with the relationship of the organization to the individual. And some of his ideas certainly apply to church institutions, and he's continuing to do research on the application of his ideas in church institutions, as well as nationally recognized for much of the work he's done in organizational behavior. So it really is my pleasure to introduce my good friend Todd Bridge, who will talk to us on Back from the Future, and then Professor Bonner Ritchie will comment on these two papers.
Now that Jim has turned the recorder back on, I suppose I'll refrain from my apology to him that I didn't provide him any beautiful grandchildren. And I'd also like him to explain to my wife what that's about. As soon as I gave Sunstone the title of this talk, I began to fear what might be inferred from it. I saw images of Plato's cave and remembered the phrase, "I have seen the future and it is ours." So I must start with a disclaimer. I've not been outside the cave, nor have I seen more of the future than those flashes and fragments available to any observer. If anything, 10 years of studying futurist writers has convinced me that remarkably little can be known about the future. The title is actually a statement about my own interests. My early academic career was focused on two main topics, 18th century art and aesthetics, especially Winckelmann, and the relations of art and society. All that the title was meant to imply that was after 10 years in which I concentrated my research on efforts to forecast the future, I have returned to the subject matter of my early career. The reason is that I have left the rather exciting and heady field of future studies for the dusty archives of the 18th century and even mustier world of Marxist art criticism. Well, I hope, emerged from the personal view of the futures movement that I will now develop. I might just make one slight comment here before I ask for my apologies, which I will proceed when I finally get in that bottom of my paper, which comes just before the conclusion. I have not dealt specifically with why I consider the future as movement a movement, but I think you'll notice all the way through that I'm not talking about anyone who wants to think about the future, but about a specific movement, I think, in the traditional sense that we use that in social or artistic terminology. Before I begin to describe the leading developments of the movement, I should note that I will concentrate primarily on the matters of values, transcendence, and religion as they relate to writers and thinkers about the future. In this way, I hope to make my comments relevant, in some way at least, to this symposium. The desire to know about the future is, of course, as old as history, and many of those methods have been developed in hopes of achieving some measure of information about them. But except for a few isolated instances, such as the works of Condorcet in the 18th century, not many of these efforts were built on scientific, that's with quotation mark, foundations. In more recent times, projection has formed an important part of some disciplines, economics for example, but it was only during the period between the two world wars that more general forecasts of the human future were attempted. And almost all of these early efforts were brought to a halt by the Second World War. But though World War II interrupted some efforts at forecasting, it was to provide the impetus for the development of institutions beyond the future projection. In the United States, the effects of the war were direct. The first major forecasting institution, the RAND Corporation, developed from the R&D section of the military and was initially supported almost exclusively from Air Force contracts. Later, of course, RAND, led by Olaf Helmer and Norman Dalkey, moved from defense matters to a variety of social and quality of life topics. It is not surprising that RAND first achieved national notoriety within the two of Herman Kahn's studies on thermonuclear war, and of course that's when Kahn became Dr. Strangelove and preserved eternity, I suppose, along with celluloid last by Strangelove. The future movement was led by Alfred Fleischheim, a coiner of the term futurology, who had spent the war in the United States, and Robert Moke, a Jewish science writer who eventually became a professor of sociology at Salzburg and then later at the Freie Universität in Berlin. For obvious reasons, both of these men feared the concentration of power of the new science and technology in the hands of totalitarian rulers. But in their early work, at least, they concentrated almost exclusively around methods of forecasting, especially technological forecasting. Only after varying experience with students in the 60s did they turn to issues related to values matters. Bertrand de Jumeral, the founder of the French Futurist Movement, was an eminent political scientist whose book on sovereignty was the standard work of the subject. The Jumeral, who took the art of conjecture, challenged the possibility of scientific forecasting, also concentrated on the impact of technology, although as might be expected, he was particularly interested in how technological developments would affect political relations, including the war. Aside from these three kinds of things, it's impossible to mention more. Edward Dyson Calder, for example, is a major scientist. The point I want to emphasize is the futurist movement was developed by scholars who were particularly interested in forecasting and perhaps controlling technological and scientific development. Most of the early futurists could also be called technological optimists. While they were generally more afraid of the possibility of thermonuclear war than was the average citizen, they thought in technology the possibility, perhaps the probability, of solving many of the world's economic, nutritional, population, and even political problems. Thus it was understandable that when in 1970 the first general meetings of the largest of all future organizations, the World Future Society, were held, they ended on very optimistic notes. While some of the social problems of the late 60s dampened enthusiasm a little, and the Vietnam War still thought to be winnable, especially by the futurists, I should mention. One of the most wonderful projections in the world to me is the great MIT political scientist Isidro de Sola Poole's projections of how the Vietnam War will be won. I mean, this is one of those cases when where they have been fairly completed, and it's fascinating. Despite the big thing cloud of the variety, the conference generally concluded that with a bit of luck, technology and technological and social science would solve most of the world's present problems. Luckily for those of us who are interested in the future as much as we are in the future, one of those attending the World Future Society chose to study the group itself. Mark Gray's survey proved to be very revealing. A high proportion of those attending the conference were well-educated, well-paid, and from a business and intellectual establishment. They also tended toward liberalism in politics and toward non-conformity in their religious views. They were also overwhelmingly white and male. Most were doing well and expected to do even better in the future. The participants in the conference were much caught up with the world, and neither they nor the topics they treated revealed any particular interest in religious or transcendental values. But this situation was soon to change. Actually, the change was already underway. Although not really deep in religion in traditional sense, Helen Kahn's the year 2000, and I'll give you some publication dates now here because I think they're important for kind of following the course of the movement. In 1967, on borrowed terminology from the religiously oriented sociologist Petri Sorokin, and the report of the commission of the year 2000, 1968, edited by Daniel Bell, also hinted at such issues. In 1969, Meyer and Rescher published Values in the Future, a work in which religion is surprisingly on the periphery, but nonetheless there. But it was the publication of two very different works that led to serious consideration of transcendental issues by the futurists. The first of these was Alvin Toffler's Future Shock, published in 1970. Toffler is notoriously ignorant about religious matters. If one looks up religion on the index, one will realize more often than not to such topics as homosexuality, alternate lifestyles, communism, etc. But he treated many topics that have been traditionally relegated to church and religion. Thus, his discussions of Syrian marriage, clothing, and gender caused non-religious people to feel that they're no more interested in the direction things are going. The second, under the Futurist Movement, far more influential book was The Limits to Growth, 1972, edited by Dennis Meadows et al. And published by the Club of Rome. In some ways, this book did not deserve the reception it received. Despite its genesis on the J. Forrester World II model and the reputation of MIT's computer scientists, the report was written in a sloppy fashion, the specific model was weak, and the main message that resource depletion, population explosion, and pollution would bring on the demise of the growth-oriented Western economic system has been stated better in previous publications. But the prestige lent the report by its industrialist sponsors was immense. Almost immediately, the foundation was cut away from the technological optimists. Only a few, such as Simon Ramo and Herman Kahn, held on. Yellow, seeing the end of industrialism, started to regroup and to look for ways to confront an era of slowed or reversed economic growth. And soon a cry rang up for new values, something that would transform us from materialist consumers to friends of the earth. Thus, by the time of the second conference of the World Economic Society in 1975, the emphasis of the lectures and panels had taken a dramatic turn. Sessions were held on a wide range of value systems. Though the technological optimists were still present, they were obviously in a minority. A few of the sessions were quite rewarding. In one, several theologians and a practicing churchman including the Episcopal Bishop of Washington, dealt with the future orientation that has characterized traditional Christianity. But a clue to the development of disturbing new trend arose when a psychic and two practicing witches outdrew the church figures. The first of these new trends I mentioned was the practice of futurists to try and invent their new values out of whole cloth. And the second was their tendency to equate religion and transcendence with the non-rational, whatever its source. Two examples of the whole cloth practice were the Club of Rome panel on values in the future and Willis Harmon's Stanford Research Institute study for the Kettering Foundation that resulted in the changing images of man. The Club of Rome, after their limits to growth, decided to appoint Erwin Laszlo and a commission of scholars to deal with values issues. The initial report of the panel was shockingly naive. The panelists seemed like the worst parody of Enlightenment optimists who believed that they could propose an essentially Judeo-Christian ethical system without bothering with all the troublesome theology. When questioned about traditional religion, several members appeared to be annoyed that such matters would even be mentioned. Later, when they published their study, Goals for Mankind, 1977, Laszlo and his colleagues included a chapter on the great religions and world solidarity. This chapter, however, is little more than a compilation of statements from various religions about oneness and unity and brotherhood. While admirable, the statements and the panel's analysis thereof seem unaware that religion actually is believed, and that believers often feel that God is real and important. Harmon's work, begun in the early 70s and published first in 1981, or 82, the copyright is 82, the publication date's 81, and it's a strange, not that one would have to be about it, it isn't one of the books I'd go looking up, but anyway. It's one of the worst, it's an example of the worst type of value engineering. Why Harmon was selected to do a study of this type is uncertain. His background is in electrical engineering, and his initial work, I don't think that electrical engineers don't have values. I just think that other people have done formal studies of values a little bit more. Anyway, his initial work dealing with humans developed from systems analysis. None of his early work or training dealt with religion or values matters, and this fact becomes immediately obvious. The changing image of mankind, that's the name of the book, is a confusing mix of Joseph Campbell's systems analysis and naive views of religion. At its best, it is harmless, and at its worst, it drifts towards transformationalism, certainly the worst and most dangerous development of the futurist movement. The term transformationalism is used frequently in today's discussion of the future. Unfortunately, a number of different meanings seem to be included in the word, but most transformationalists believe that humankind is on the verge of a new stage of its development, that we have reached a new human development, human-directed point in our evolution. Most transformationists feel that all aspects of human life are presently undergoing a profound change, and that the new human that emerges will differ from the old in vocation, social relations, and spirit. Within the futurist movement, transformationalism probably can trace its roots to the work of Barbara Marx Hubbard, Hazel Henderson, Alvin Toffler, and others. I suspect, however, that if one were to probe deeper, one would find that many of its adherents were 60s rebels, and that their guru was Charles Rice, author of Scream of America. That was a 1970 publication as well. Among the transformationalists whose writings are most popular are Hubbard, Marilyn Ferguson, The Aquarian Conspiracy, Fritjof Capra, The Tao of Physics, and Alvin Toffler with his Third Wave. People who believe that the world is preparing to leap to a new level, bringing in a new woman, I put in a very nasty little parenthesis there, which I suppose I should, I call it a Hebrew problem, but I don't know if all of you will know that that's a parody of Nietzsche, but anyway, and new men are not necessarily dangerous, of course, but I believe that some transformationalists are. Part of their danger comes from the fact that many of them believe in a new Gnosticism, that they insist that they know the direction the world is going without feeling any obligation towards explaining the source of those feelings. the non-negotiable demands of the 1960s have become the non-discussable faith of the 1980s. Take, for example, Fritjof Capra. Some of you may have seen a short interview with him in Brian Kiefner's The Doomsayers. Then he remarked that his own involvement in Zen and other non-traditional religious and meditation experiences had convinced him that the ways of the future lead to those directions. When asked about the fact that polls and other studies actually show a resurgence of traditional, somewhat conservative religion, Capra replied that this phenomenon was simply the last gasp of the old order. Capra could be right, but that's not the point. He feels no obligation to discuss the reasons behind or the evidence for his belief. Like many of his fellows, he feels that his own experience is a paradigm for the world as a whole. I suppose that a parenthetical remark is needed here. I recognize that in any religious system, the relationship between belief, knowledge, ethical system, and behavior is enormously complex. And I would not condemn Catherine or any other transformationalist if they could not explain all their feelings and beliefs in a systematic way. But I start worrying about the Bluetooth-Bolden aspects of intuitive schemes when individuals glory in obscurity, relish the unknowable, reject discussion, and they feign incredulity and amusement when others see the world in a somewhat different light. One element of the 1960s culture that the transformationalist is not part and parcel is an aversion toward rational discussion. Two other disturbing elements of transformationalist thought are perhaps best illustrated in Toffler's third wave. One of these is a hidden determinism, in Toffler's case, Marxist materialist, and the other is a distortion of data and evidence that would make even Procrustes blush. To the matter of determinism, because of their great fondness for biological metaphor, most transformationalists have come to use the term evolution to describe change in society and individuals. I've written a reply to this usage that's based on Karl Popper, and it can't be repeated here. Popper, however, sees human society as moving in waves, each of which is dominated by a means of production. The first wave by agriculture, the second by industry, and the third by post-industrial electronic cottage information shuffling blank. There's no noun there, but I don't think that's my fault. Toffler, who is rarely at a loss for coined words, never seems to be able to quite settle on one term to describe this new ethic. Because the economic system is at the center of each of these ways, other aspects of society have little choice but to follow along. At best, the receding elements of one wave can be kept afloat a while by getting caught up in the inrushing new wave. Naturally, Popper assumes that religion and values will follow the new electronic era and will change significantly from the industrial values of the second wave. But it's useless in this scheme to resist. Although Popper talks of a greater freedom in the future, the freedom is of a strange sort. It does not really include many of the choices many would deem important. Popper's thesis about the decline of traditional religious values and institutions can be verified only if one ignores two centuries of data. And it is in his use of supporting evidence that his distortion of material becomes evident. As he must to be true to this scheme, Toffler connects Judeo-Christian religious tradition to the first or agrarian wave. Such a connection implies that Christianity should have been collapsing as the industrial age advanced. But Toffler can cite no evidence to support this thesis. It is true that some see secularization of the West in the wake of the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution, but other measures, such as church membership and attendance, would indicate that the industrial society actually saw strengthening of institutional Christianity. Toffler's strategy in this case is simply to ignore the question altogether. Because of this tactic, repeated almost ad nauseum, the reader is never able to evaluate evidence and arguments about the radical values changes that Toffler anticipates. Instead, one is led to accept or reject his species simply on whether or not one accepts Toffler's special, perhaps irregular, insight. I began this digression on transformationalism, in my opinion, the worst of all developments of the futurist movement, with a passing comment on Willis Harmon. But perhaps the digression did not lead us too far astray. For I believe that the futurist movement, left technological optimism to search for new values, two major developments coincided. The first, as I mentioned, was a quasi-enlightenment attempt to unleash religious values from faith and theology. The second was transformationalism. But for me, the question is why these two developments emerged rather than a term to traditional religion or philosophy is still intriguing. One of the reasons futurists preferred new development is connected with an almost total lack of historical awareness on the part of most of them. In an article I published a few years ago, I argued that one of the causes of the miserable forecasting record of many professional projectors lies in our lack of awareness that anything happened before 1960. The futurists ignore by choice. They need to believe that the future will be so different that the past is not relevant. The 1980 conference of the World Future Society saw a belated and largely unsuccessful attempt to form an organization of Christian futurists. And although the general meetings were attended by a large number of professional religionists, the dominant sessions were held by the transformationalists. Barbara Marx Hubbard, another feminist, held a session which was called The Reawakening of Eve, in which they announced that, I'm quoting now, whenever a new human phase is coming, woman seems to be the first to become aware and lead the way. That's the end of the quote. This pronouncement was not debated on any historical basis, which it possibly could have been. Instead, it was simply pronounced. But pronouncement was the order of the day. We were all told that the new age was upon us, that the new human was emerging, that a new peaceful, non-materialistic, non-sexist, non-acquisitive ethic was arriving. A few even gave us our assignments. As some of the enlightened, we should, in unacknowledged Marxist terminology, become midwives and shorten and lessen the birth pangs of the emerging culture. But as Marx also argued, it would be impossible to withstand that which was emerging. The technologists were still in attendance in Toronto in 1980. In small sessions, they got together and showed off their new microcomputers and discussed the possibility of bubble memories, mechanobiological fusion, the implication of satellite TV for political campaigns, for the possibility of information-based management systems. But it was clear the stars were elsewhere. Even Herman Kahn, sticking to his predictions of an affluent future for the world, drew fewer listeners than some of the lesser-known transformationalists. In 1981, Salt Lake City was host to what was probably the most disturbing of all futurist meetings. The education session of the World section of the World Future Society met at the Hotel Utah in its fourth annual conference. There, the featured speaker was Marilyn Ferguson. After a rather long commercial for her book and an explanation that the New Age was emerging because monkeys on certain islands were all washing their clams after one rice monkey had started the practice, she had us all stand and hold. Maybe I better explain that reference. One of the things that one attempts to do occasionally when one is demonstrating that massive societal changes are coming is to demonstrate that they come in shocking and universal. She likes to borrow Kuhn's paradigm shift terminology, albeit not understanding. Shouldn't say that, at least choosing not to understand Kuhn at all, but her argument was based in two things. One is that the first time a scientist tries to discover a
or to develop a new crystal, he's unsuccessful. But as soon as one scientist does it, then all kinds of scientists are able to do it. Now, it seems to me that one explanation for that phenomenon was is that the first scientist explained to the rest of them how he did it. But her idea is that that proves that the age of that new crystal had arrived, and now it can be discovered all over the world because this is kind of the medium zeitgeist to push to its wildest implications. But the thousand monkeys has to do with the fact that the monkeys on certain islands off of Japan used to get very annoyed by the fact that there was sand in their clams, but they went on eating it anyway. And then one bright monkey went down and washed his clams in the ocean and got the sand out of them before he ate them. And that then in turn, all the monkeys in all of Japan all started washing their clams, which must be a demonstration that the time for clam washing had arrived. And now we are now seeing the evidences that the new age had come because the crystals and clams could be...
The most intriguing point was supposed to be that the monkey on the other island had no idea
that this one monkey was doing it. That's right.
So he couldn't have learned it.
All right. I'm somewhere in mid-sentence. I think I started with an after. Something about after a rather long commercial, etc. She had us all stand and hold hands while she played a tape of a young man singing a guitar-accompanied anthem of the New Age. Apparently it was a good song, because Ms. Ferguson stood weeping while others hugged each other. I was happy that I was too far away from any of the other educators to reach out and touch them. My palms were sweating and my head was reeling. Here were teachers and professors, mostly in their 30s and early 40s, who were still trying to capture the feeling of their college days when they had enthralled each other with visions of a new world. For me, the 18th century looked more rational, more fascinating, and surprisingly more modern than the future for which they were.
Todd's only problem is that he's too uptight about people holding hands and listening to folk music.
We can do that now.
And, so I'd like to ask y'all to stand and turn the lights out and we'll... And Scott has just way more optimism than I'm comfortable with, that the right stories are going to be told that reinforce the values that we really want. I don't have a need to find a common theme, but there is one, whether there's a need or not. And that common theme is very simply the potential abuse of people via the mechanism of the tyranny of ideology, the tyranny of science, the tyranny of individual power, the process by which organizational values reinforce those things that destroy rather than enhance the dignity of the individual, the process by which we somehow develop a value system that undercuts rather than creates a mechanism by which we reinforce those things that are eternally valid. And therefore, it seems to me that the convergence is in the notion that values are preeminent, that the underpinnings of technological change, social change, organizational change, doctrinal change, social stability, are always found in the stories that are told that reinforce a set of values that enable people to interpret those events in ways that reinforce rather than destroy that fragile identity that enables us to maintain sanity and involvement and effort. But, lest we become too optimistic with Todd's
technical optimist, let's remember that we still have the high potential to disseminate those values that lead to the incarceration and murder of millions of people that disagree with it. That excommunicate people who disagree with it. That create a process by which somehow those who are on the edges are not protected by those stories that need to be told of B.H. Roberts. What are those stories in fact? Sure, they exist in our history. But in my experience, they're not as frequent as I would like to see them, given my value bias. I'm not so troubled by the notion that somehow, in the macro sense of organizational evolution, we do have the demise of those organizations whose values do not allow individuals to achieve individually defined worthwhile goals within the organization's structure. That's a long sentence. My point is, when the organization doesn't allow people to achieve their goals, the organization dies. The problem is, in the meantime, 6 million of them are killed. The problem is, in the meantime, a lot of them hit the streets and are rejected and alienated in a way that precludes the capacity to be a strength to the organization. I totally agree that in the macro, long-term sense, the system is self-disciplining. In a macro, short-term sense, a lot of people have a lot of pain. And that's who I'm concerned with. Not the long-term capacity or potential of the system to right itself, but the short-term cost in people's mental health, in people's value systems who want to vote differently than somebody tells them to vote, or want to belong to a different organization than somebody says is appropriate, or want to believe in a political cause that some authoritarian uptight in the short run undisciplined leader pronounces as true, or a foreign speech or devotion of BYU that those heresies with a kind of rejecting rigor that categorically dismisses those who dare to think and state their position. It's the short-term cost that I worry about, not the long-term ability of systems to have that self discipline regenerating process that allows, not only allows, but demands the kind of creative adaptation and change that we know takes place in organizations that survive, which is about 10% of organizations that come into existence after 5 years. So it's a fairly high-cost world, and most young women, I suppose, yes, most deserve to go into it. But a few women that don't deserve it, and a few stay around that don't deserve it. And those two categories impose enormous costs on people who dare to think differently, who dare to state their positions, who dare to feel and be sensitive in times when others impose arbitrary and rigid definitions of what is right and acceptable. So let's tell those stories that reinforce those values, that provide for the free exchange of ideas, that provide for the dignity of the individual in terms of different people having respect and being heard rather than ostracized and rejected. Let's demonstrate those values in our daily life rather than defaulting to a pronouncement of an authoritarian leader or an edict of some sort that we find comfortable to follow at the expense of individual responsibility for thinking, analyzing, and taking a stand. But the burden is on each of us to tell those stories. And for developing those ideologies, because the system doesn't have any conscience. Only people within the system have a conscience, and it's only that conscience that keeps those stories going. It's only that conscience and that risk, often, on the part of the individual, that prevents the zealot in technology or theology or social movement from abusing the thousands of millions of people along the way. I find it funny that in my field, the dominant literature of the past few years has clearly developed a kind of dynamic tension paradigm that says the only organizations that survive are those that provide two things simultaneously. One is a feeling of intense identity and loyalty, and the other is the protection of an intense autonomous independence for the individual. The capacity to identify with an organization, a movement, a society with passion, and at the same time detach yourself from it with the freedom to be different and not destroyed because of that difference. Now, when an organization creates that, when an authoritarian centralized IBM can spin off a Boca Raton IBM PC project with a Charlie Chaplin metaphor, stopping the small ways because it's more compelling than the printed circuits within that computer, there's hope. But in the meantime, most of organizations and most of IBM aren't that way. It can happen, but it only happens when people not only go out on their own, it's got what they normally go out on in terms of women receiving the priesthood. Not only do they go out on that limb, but when they go out far enough to shake the tree, to make it very unstable. Because it's that dynamic tension between firm identity and deviant rebellion that leads to the retelling of the stories that do preserve the dignity of the individual, that do preserve the right of free inquiry, that do preserve the capacity and the potential for testing and for change. And that's a burden that can never be surrendered to any organizational leader or to any institutional constitution or to any cultural value system that will somehow carry itself. So I agree with both Todd and Scott. I just remind you that there outcomes don't come automatically. They come with highly risk-taking people who are willing to do some pretty dangerous things. And when that doesn't happen, then those stories are all told of the cost of deviance, the loss of virtue of those who don't accept what somebody states is the accepted line. Those who, in Toffler's terms, let the future committees manage our advent into tomorrow with some scientific control system that tells us how to interpret, how to protect, how to implement, how to transform from one system to another. And when everybody has those kinds of answers in the scientific community, in the academic community, in the athletic world, in the church, I get scared. And as long as we can take that stand, and as long as we can tell those stories and voice those concerns, and generate those values that protect free inquiry, more than conformity, that protect difference more than obedience, will we be able to bring that off? I think they're an interesting attempt to tell us what societal and organizational control system can mean and do, and when it can be useful and when it can be destructive, when it can undercut and when it can reinforce. And in that process, I hope that we would choose the right side. Thank you. We thank all the participants and this program is adjourned.